We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. And this is ACAM Learn.
Welcome to Mind the Kids, a podcast series dedicated to exploring the latest advancements in child and adolescent mental health research and practice. I'm Clara, an academic clinical fellow in child psychiatry, and I'm passionate about understanding and addressing the diverse mental health challenges faced by young people globally. In this series, I will be joined by renowned researchers and clinicians from around the world to discuss their cutting-edge research, innovative interventions, and best practices in child and adolescent mental health. Today, I have the pleasure of receiving Dr. Tessa Reardon, a research fellow in the departments of experimental psychology and psychiatry at the University of Oxford. And we're going to be discussing her paper, Parent-led CBT for Young Children Identified as at Risk for Anxiety Disorders, a cluster randomized controlled trial, which was just published at the JCPP. It's an honor to have you here, Dr. Reardon. Thank you so much for accepting to do this podcast with us. And if you could start by telling us a bit about yourself and your research journey so far.
Yes, of course. And thanks so much for having me. I'm really, really delighted to have the opportunity to come and talk about this research. So I grew up in the UK and would benefit from having access to state-funded, really good quality schooling that I think really helped me to develop curiosity about the world and really valuing and wanting to, I guess, make a positive contribution to society. And then I went on to study psychology as my undergraduate degree in Swansea in Wales. And following my first degree, my kind of introduction into the world of research was actually educational research. So I worked for a charity doing educational research. And alongside that, I trained to be an English language teacher. And I went to live in a few different places in the world, I think mostly because I wanted to experience living and working in different parts of the world and in different cultures. And I returned to psychology actually in Australia. So I lived in Australia for a couple of years and worked as a research assistant in a couple of different institutions, working with teams really focused on child and adolescent mental health research. And that's really what inspired me to then go on to do a PhD within this field. So I came back to the UK and I did a PhD working with Cathy Creswell at the University of Reading. And my PhD really focused on families' experiences of seeking help for anxiety problems, specifically among primary school age children. And really in that work, we were trying to understand the challenges that families face accessing support. And I've been really fortunate, I think, since then to be able to really to be conducting research that builds on that work that I did within my PhD to develop and evaluate and implement really approaches that are designed to try to minimise and reduce some of those kind of really common barriers and challenges that families face seeking and accessing support, including this study that we're talking about today.
No, that's amazing. And I think in this study, clearly focus on anxiety and children experience at high risk for an anxiety disorder in schools. And I think this is just such an important topic right now, because we know that the prevalence of mental health conditions among children and young people is increasing. But I think there's also some really interesting data from like the Mental Health of Children and Young People National Survey showing that actually the prevalence of sub-threshold symptoms is also increasing. So clearly, even if people don't meet a diagnostic criteria for like a full-blown diagnosis, they're still experiencing a lot of distressing symptoms, and anxiety and depression are among the most common ones. And your paper, you did a trial trying to evaluate outcomes from therapist-supported online CBT for supporting parents to deliver the CBT to young children from, as you said, primary schools that were identified as at risk for an anxiety disorder. So can you tell us a bit more about the rationale? And you said you were building up on your PhD work and the specific gaps you were trying to cover.
Yes, yeah, of course. I mean, so exactly as you say, really, this was very much in the context of this kind of growing understanding and awareness of this gap between need for mental health support and intervention and really receipt of evidence-based care, with children and young people often not accessing support or having to wait really long periods to do so, and for difficulties really to be quite severe before they're able to access services. And it was really my PhD research that really pointed to, I guess, the potential role for schools here to try to bring support to families and try to minimise some of those barriers associated with accessing external support. And really, I think just kind of the extent of the challenges that families can face before even being kind of confronted with those oversubscribed services. So specifically in the context of anxiety problems and kind of early signs of anxiety problems in children, parents often talk about really difficulties kind of making decisions or judgments about whether kind of early signs of difficulties with fears and worries are really something to be concerned about or not. Parents often report worries about and or experience really of being blamed or being made to feel they're to blame for their child's difficulties, which really can make it hard to seek support, as well as just a lot of uncertainty about how best to go about doing that. And really kind of in parallel to planning this study, we were doing some research focused on slightly older primary school age children, and we'd been working with families and school staff to develop an approach really to try to address some of these key barriers around seeking support by identifying children with anxiety problems through schools and actively offering those families interventions through a school setting. And it was really that work that I think started to make us think about the potential benefit of, I guess, trying to really intervene that bit earlier as well. So trying to reach children at a younger age and perhaps children who aren't yet necessarily experiencing significant difficulties with anxiety, but are at kind of heightened risk. So maybe more likely than their peers to go on to do so. And as you said, really in the UK, there hadn't been any trials that had evaluated providing a CBT intervention for children, at kind of young children under 8 who are heightened risk for going on to develop anxiety disorders. So that was the key gap that we were really trying to set out to address here in this study.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think, as you said, particularly thinking about this younger children group, like 4 to 7, which was the group you focused on, well, the threshold for CAM services is so high, and lots of parents are like in a limbo just even before they think about going to a GP to look for help.
Yeah, exactly. It's just so tricky. It's like hurdle after hurdle after hurdle.
Oh, it is. And I suppose in the beginning of the podcast, when you're talking about your background, you mentioned that one of the things you really, really liked about the UK, which I suppose is one of the things I really like about the UK as well, is your access to state-funded education. And I think here, you know, we do have access to a state-funded health system, which is a wonderful thing. I think the principles of the NHS are amazing. I think at the moment, but it's been building up, right? Services are so overstretched, and we definitely need something to bridge the gap. Because as you said, the threshold for CAMS is just so high. And actually, this is something I talk to the consultants I work with. Like, lots of them, they're like, they see the families are struggling, but they're like, oh, I know this child is not going to meet the threshold for a CAMS referral. And it's just like, there's just this huge gap in provision and research as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But what I wanted to talk to you about, it's so, as you said, you focused on really young children, so age 4 to 7. And I think in terms of developing like anxiety symptoms, this is a really important developmental window. But what, like, both in terms of the literature, but also your PhD work, like what do we know about this age group in terms of like developing interventions and how kind of did you approach this problem, considering it's such a, I think one of the big novelties of your study is precisely using such a young age group.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I guess we think mental health problems more broadly often do start kind of early in life, but anxiety disorders particularly are characterized by often really starting at a young age. And there's a meta-analysis from a couple of years ago where they've combined findings from across studies that is really striking, that the most frequent kind of age of onset, so when a disorder is first kind of diagnosable, for some types of anxiety disorders, is just 5.5 years of age. So it is a really frequent age of onset, this kind of early young childhood period. And so if where we are thinking about kind of intervening and providing support before difficulties do really become more ingrained and ongoing, when we're thinking about that in the context of anxiety problems, we do need to be including and thinking about providing support for really quite young children. I think there was another consideration specifically for this project, where right from the beginning and kind of throughout the delivery, and I guess now as well, we were always thinking about how could this work in practice, partly because of that gap that you've referred to. We were thinking about how can we help fill this gap kind of going forward. So we were very much thinking about how the kind of school system works, and particularly schools in England. And so part of the rationale for the specific age range that we're focused on was kind of tying into the school years in the English schooling system. So we were focused on the first three kind of formal years of education.
That's really, that makes total sense, and actually links really well to my next question, because I was still speaking about like the methods and the design of the study. I was going to ask why you chose to focus on schools as your main like recruitment. Just thinking with my clinician hat on, and you've mentioned that as well, right? Like some families, they go to GPs, but sometimes they also go to counselors, but you chose schools as your recruiting unit. And yeah, if you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And I think that was kind of, that definitely was what I think we would see as kind of a key feature of the design of this study, was choosing to kind of focus on schools. I mean, perhaps the first thing to say is this isn't, focusing on schools doesn't mean that this is the only route and the place to be offering and providing support. That of course there are different routes, and different routes are going to suit different families. But it was very much both, I guess, findings from my PhD research, and then also kind of the wider kind of context, and including kind of policy context, that did inform this decision. So certainly in my PhD research, those kind of common challenges that families talked about, identifying anxiety problems and then going on to seek kind of help for those anxiety problems, by identifying children through schools and delivering and offering support through schools, it is very much you have this opportunity to really bring support to where families are, and try to remove that need to kind of navigate this really complicated process. So that certainly was a key aspect of it. We were also keen to use this approach of using screening questionnaires, or questionnaires to identify children through schools, where they're offered universally, again as a way to try to kind of minimise that demand on parents to necessarily make that decision or judgment to say, yes, I need to go and ask for help, where it's kind of more actively being brought and offered to them, and then using the responses to those screening questionnaires to kind of make an offer of support. And then I guess alongside that, this, I think, probably internationally really, but certainly here in the UK, kind of growing recognition and importance attached to the role of schools. So again, kind of thinking right from planning this study and for going forwards, how there is very much interest and attention towards providing support through school settings. And in England now, we have mental health support teams linked with and working with increasing numbers of schools. So very much from kind of the planning stage of this study, we were thinking those teams really provide kind of a trained potential workforce kind of going forwards to work with schools to deliver these types of approaches. But I guess that's not to say there's not challenges with working with schools too. I mean, schools are incredibly busy places, which perhaps is inherent to schools, but certainly, as you've mentioned, I mean, within this context of kind of strip back public services around schools, those demands on schools are ever increasing. And certainly that was something that we kind of were mindful of and thinking about all the way through planning and delivering this project, where we worked really closely with school staff to think about how the procedures might work, and trying as much as possible to minimise additional demands on school staff.
That's very sensible. And it's really interesting that you and your team tapped into the potential of mental health support teams. I was going to mention them. I think it's a really interesting feature in England for our listeners from other parts of the world. Yeah, there's been this very landmark paper by the government called the Green Paper, which kind of set rules about the provision of mental health support in schools, precisely because schools are such an important, as you said, right, important place in children's lives. And I also think, I don't know if how it works in other countries, but I think it's really interesting that besides the mental health support teams in the UK, you also have the figure of the educational psychologist, and you have like a whole apparatus around the school that is there to provide mental health support.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, schools, we do know from kind of the national mental health surveys that schools often are the first point of contact for families who do have concerns related to mental health, but also wider concerns. So they often do have kind of a key role in signposting and linking up families with other more specialist services. Yeah.
And it's really interesting about the challenges you mentioned, because other people that I've also asked about working with schools kind of all said the same thing in terms of how, like, it's about you fitting into the routine of the school and not you expecting that, you know, the school will adapt to when you want to do things with them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, in this study, we had a fantastic team that worked really hard to build really good relationships with staff within schools. And so this trial was called the My Cats trial. And so in each school, we had a kind of nominated lead point of contact in the school who was the My Cats lead. And so both they were liaising with our research team, but then also the point of contact for queries or concerns from parents as well. And of course, that did vary across schools, but it was really striking how it was within those schools where there were individual members of staff that had really good, strong, trusted relationships with families that often played a really important role, in particularly in that kind of initial engagement and sign-up process and supporting families to complete questionnaires. And actually, in this study particularly, it was really interesting because we were working with younger children. It was often kind of staff in support roles, so staff with perhaps pastoral support kind of responsibilities that kind of knew families really well in the school, but were really, really critical.
Yeah, that makes sense that would have been key. And speaking of the intervention in your study, so the intervention was parent-led CBT. And what I also thought it was interesting is that the intervention was supported by a therapist, right? So parents could receive support over the phone to deliver the intervention. So for our listeners who are not familiar with parent-led CBT, can you tell us a bit more about what the intervention looks like and like about also the decision to include the therapist support remotely to deliver it? And yeah.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So the intervention that we used in this study was called OSSIE, so Online Support and Intervention for Child Anxiety. So parents have access to a website, and the content is kind of includes kind of really easy to read written text, but then information presented another way. So there are video testimonials from parents and animations, and all the written content is available as audio recordings too. And parents often talk about kind of being able to listen to it on the move while they're doing other things. And so parents work through the kind of online content over a series of modules, and each module, it's designed to take about 20 minutes. And each module is then supported by a telephone call or a video call. So a short conversation within the study. It was a children's wellbeing practitioner who were graduates trained in delivering these types of brief CBT interventions. And really, those support calls are really provide an opportunity for a parent to kind of check in with their understanding around the content, and really to kind of provide support and encouragement, help support the family with addressing any challenges, problem solving any challenges that might crop up along the way. And it is really striking how both in this study and in other studies where the intervention has been evaluated, that parents do really talk about those support calls as feeling like a really important component of the intervention, both as kind of a motivator, could kind of keep keep going, and also just as an opportunity to work through challenges that might crop up, and perhaps where to support parents with tailoring or adapting particular strategies for kind of their particular child's kind of needs or circumstances. And so in this, the intervention originally had been designed for slightly older children and also children with anxiety disorders. And so as part of this study at the start, we did do some work to make actually fairly minor changes to the content of the intervention, just tweaking, moving some of the more clinical language and ensuring examples and things were appropriate for younger children as well, and children who might not be experiencing significant difficulties with anxiety. So kind of over the course of the intervention, parents kind of learn strategies that are CBT-based strategies for them to kind of use and apply in day-to-day life with their child. So some of the early content really focuses on supporting parents, I guess, to gain an understanding of those anxious thoughts their child might be having. So bad things that they think might happen in situations that might be scary. And so there's some strategies around having conversations or talking to children around fears and worries. And then some strategies that are designed really to support parents, to support children to kind of test out some of those anxious thoughts in really gradual and supportive ways, as well as activities around problem solving and promoting problem solving and building confidence through kind of gaining independence. So really cognitive behavioral strategies that you would see across other types of CBT interventions that are delivered in kind of different formats. And certainly this way of delivering the intervention, where the support is all provided remotely, both where the content is delivered digitally, obviously brings the advantage of being able to parents to be able to access it, kind of fit it readily around their day-to-day life. And then similarly, the support being provided remotely by telephone or video call similarly allows parents to kind of accommodate that within their busy lives perhaps more readily than attending a face-to-face appointment. And certainly that the amount of kind of contact time within this intervention, so in the study, it's about 2.5 hours over the course of the intervention. So certainly a lot less than you would see in a kind of standard CBT intervention that's delivered directly to children, which does bring efficiencies when you're thinking about trying to maximise the number of children that could receive this type of support.
Sense, but I suppose the advantage of the parent-led is that you can bring scale very easily, right? Like, we have such a shortage of CBT trained therapists that,
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is really striking as well, where you talk to families that of kind of family parents of primary school age children, that often kind of really want to be able to support their child as the family, and have often concerns about a child going to see a therapist or someone independently, but it's kind of having the confidence and knowing how best to do that. And so a parent-led approach does bring advantages too, where there might be concerns actually about a child kind of having missing school or going to a clinic or attending face-to-face sessions with the clinician.
And in terms of outcomes, so the primary outcome you and your team chose was the presence of an anxiety disorder diagnosis at 12 months post-intervention. And I thought it was so interesting because you did find reduced rates of a diagnosis in the group that received the intervention compared to the group that didn't. However, that difference was not statistically significant. But, and there's an important but for our listeners who haven't read the paper, all the secondary outcomes were statistically significant. So things like parental anxiety symptoms and child self-reported symptoms, all of those things were significantly reduced in the group that received the intervention. And I think my first question is, why did you choose that outcome in terms of, I think, especially considering you're using a population that wasn't necessarily looking for clinical help, like you know, it was a school population that screened high for anxiety. Why this outcome, and how did you make sense of these findings?
Yes, yeah, thank you. I mean, this is obviously something that we have thought and talked a lot about as a team. I think primarily we chose the diagnostic outcome because we were aiming to prevent the onset of diagnosable anxiety disorders. And in order to assess that, you do need to use a full diagnostic assessment. And so we set the bar high, I guess, by doing that. I mean, as you said, that at 12 months, we found that there were fewer children in the intervention arm with a diagnosable anxiety disorder than in the control group, but that difference between the groups wasn't statistically significant. So, I mean, we would, interpret that as a null result in relation to that diagnostic outcome. So this intervention didn't reduce the frequency of diagnosable anxiety disorders over that 12-month period. But as you say, because we did find positive effects across our secondary clinical outcomes, and I think it was striking for us that that was consistent across really a range of outcomes that we assessed. So really importantly, including those three risks that actually we'd assessed at the start of the study to determine inclusion. So we saw a reduction in children's anxiety symptoms, inhibition, so an inhibited temperament, parent anxiety, and also each of those child and parent behaviours that we assessed that are really targeted by the intervention and CBT interventions more broadly. So those outcomes across those secondary outcomes really do provide evidence that this intervention reduced risk for future anxiety disorders. So over 12 months, we didn't find evidence of a reduction in diagnoses, but we did find a reduction in risk for the development of future anxiety diagnoses. So, I mean, I guess the next step in an ideal world, or if we'd had enough money within this funding period, would be to follow up these families over the years ahead to determine whether that risk reduction in risk does then translate to reduction in diagnosable anxiety disorders kind of into the future and longer term. Yeah. So if anyone knows anyone who would fund that, then that would be great.
No, absolutely. And I think also, you mentioned about this in the beginning a bit, the fact that parents felt, I'm not sure, it was not in the paper, but are you guys going to do a qualitative component of the trial? Because I suppose that in terms of supporting parents feeling empowered and able to support their children throughout their primary schooling years, it's such an important thing. And I think clearly your results show that your intervention is great at doing that. So yeah, and I think this is such a big difference. And I mean, your study didn't measure that specifically, but yeah, we know that reduction in anxiety reported symptoms is also associated with higher educational achievement in children, and things that obviously you're not going to see at 12-month follow-up, but could have ripple effects later on.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yes, so our qualitative interview findings aren't in the main paper, so that they will be published soon. So we're just finalising that manuscript, just at the moment. But yeah, absolutely. So within those, we conducted interviews with parents who received the intervention as within the trial. And certainly they really do, those interviews do point to kind of wider potential benefits beyond things. So that was within the context of the trial, so wasn't assessing longer term, but certainly kind of ripple effects in children and families' lives. So kind of applying strategies and principles with other children, so with siblings and in wider relationships, and kind of feeling, parents often talk about kind of having feeling this, that they have these kind of things in their back pocket so that they can revisit it as and when, which really kind of points to the potential longer term benefits. And definitely that, what you said there, that sort of knock on ripple effect was very much a motivation for this study, that we do know that anxiety problems early in life do are associated with these, both in the short term, but also in the longer term, negative consequences for children. So this, if you can kind of change that trajectory, there's real potential for longer term benefits for kind of affected children, but also more broadly for society.
Well, I have all my fingers crossed that you'll get the funding to do lots of follow-ups and expand the trial, I suppose, especially, as you said, in terms of Because speaking of, we talk about good knock-on effects, but thinking about, I suppose, bad knock-on effects, I think just because of the threshold for accessing camps being so high at the moment, actually, you know, by the point a young person reaches camps lots of the time, so many other things have already happened to them. And then we're talking about more complex cases, which of course can be helped. And but then at that point, changing that trajectory, it's so much harder than, you know, years before. So yeah, I think those interventions are so important.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But I also, still speaking about your trial, and I suppose we talked about that a bit, that from a clinician's perspective, at the moment, we're dealing with really overstretched services, and early interventions, they just hold so much potential. And this is maybe a spoiler of your future call to study, but in terms of intervention design, again, we talked about that a bit. You mentioned parents really valued that human support element of the intervention. And yeah, and can you tell us a bit about, like, yeah, how, what the importance they placed at this support? And also, what do you think this means for digital mental health interventions going forward? Do you think that, you know, all digital mental health interventions should have that human element support option if needed, or like purely self-guided also works just as fine in certain settings?
Thanks. So certainly in the qualitative interviews in this study and in other studies too, parents do talk about the causes. Yeah, I guess providing some sort of motivation and encouragement, I think that feels really important, and also kind of practical support with resolving difficulties throughout the course of the intervention. And it is notable, I think, in this study, the completion rates that we saw within the intervention were really, like, we were really pleased with them. And when you look at them alongside other interventions where that are delivered in slightly different ways, it that really does kind of, I guess, provide us with confidence that this approach, where parents are attending and completing sessions, that's kind of evidence that you're doing something right. Where we had around 3/4 of the families completed the intervention, which, given that this is we've recruited through schools, these are children at risk, not necessarily experiencing significant difficulties, and that really is that in and of itself, I think, is encouraging. And definitely in a quite similar trial that was conducted in Australia, where they used an intervention that involved parents attending face-to-face and group sessions, the attendance rate at those sessions was much lower than we saw in this study. And what's really interesting in is when you look at the completion rates, I think, compared to digital interventions that either don't have any support, or that support is just optional. So within our intervention, the support is very much, it's the parent works with a module, completes the module, and then they have the support call before they progress on. So it's integrated within the kind of package. There was an evaluation of a digital intervention, again, in an, by a research team in Australia, where parents worked through a similar kind of website, and they were able to kind of ask for support calls, but very small numbers of families requested those calls. So it does feel like those support calls play an important role, and it does need to be really integrated and a part of the intervention rather than something that you need to ask or expect parents to kind of ask for that as an additional add-on. I think where we're kind of thinking about whether it's better or worse or kind of needed to have this integrated therapist support, it gets a bit more complicated. I mean, I'm always a bit nervous of sort of saying there's just one way of doing this and one approach is going to work for everyone. So in this approach, the support calls, definitely the evidence that we have that it feels a critical component of this intervention. But that's not to say that there isn't also a place for an unguided approach in perhaps a different setting and a different population. And certainly Sam Cartwright-Hatton, who's based in Sussex, they've recently published findings from a trial where they evaluated a really quite light touch, unguided digital intervention for parents with elevated anxiety. And they've seen positive effects compared to no interventions. And that sort of intervention, of course, is a lot less resource involved. So it might just be there's place for different types of interventions that are available for different groups of children and families at different stages with different needs. And almost it feels like that's really critical.
And that's a very sensible answer. I know also in the US and in the UK, like Jessica Schleider and Maria Lourdes do a lot in terms of self-guided digital health interventions. And their studies have been showing some really promising results. So I think it's definitely not a one-size-fits-all approach.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. That feels the important thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, to wrap up, Dr. Reardon, I think we talked a bit about that already anyway, but I would be really interested knowing, like, moving forward in the field of school-based interventions or even CBT-led interventions. Yeah, what are you looking forward to seeing next or doing next?
Oh, well, yes. Well, thank you for having me. Yeah, I've really enjoyed the conversation. I mean, I think there's lots more to do. It feels like there's always lots of questions to address and further research to do. If I may, I'll maybe just speak about an area that I'm particularly focused on at the minute. So in this trial and in one of our other school-based trials too, where a key motivation is about reaching families who are not currently reaching and accessing support and services and reaching them at an earlier stage. And in this trial, we had schools from all different parts of the country and really with varied kind of pupil populations. And we had families, varied backgrounds participating and benefiting from the intervention. But we did still see really marked disparities in participation across schools, where those schools with higher numbers of pupils from more socioeconomically disadvantaged backgrounds, fewer families participated, and particularly fewer families completed those initial screening questionnaires. So that really does point to a kind of potential an inequality in access, which is really a key, kind of feels a key focus and important area that we do need to address and keep considering kind of going forwards. And my team at the moment are planning some qualitative work where we're going to be working specifically with families living on low incomes and school staff and other practitioners who work with and support those families to think really about what may be additional or magnified barriers or challenges that those families may face kind of participating in this type of intervention when it's offered for a school setting, and perhaps additional targeted and tailored support we really need to ensure is in place for those families to ensure that we don't end up inadvertently kind of exacerbating an inequality. And so, yes, so that's definitely a key focus for me, but I think would apply more broadly as well with providing support through school setting.
That's so important, I think. Even if we think in terms about of like the effect size and the difference you can make with those groups, right? Because we know that it's very common that in lower income settings, you know, mental health disorders are more prevalent in parents, for example, just because of, you know, socioeconomic inequalities and struggles. So actually, we know that those children are much more likely to be struggling with anxiety symptoms, and these interventions for them could make such a huge difference.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Well. No, that's such important work, and I look forward to reading that that work when that's published. Maybe you can come back for another podcast. And thanks so much for being here today and for sharing with us about your paper. There will be a link to the paper in the podcast page for those of you who want to read it, but it's published in the JCPP.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.